Well, hello and welcome to the 27th Degree with Chris and Nancy, being broadcast from the BioSkills of Northeast Studio in Fall River, Massachusetts. Today we'll be discussing swallowing evaluations with Katrina Woodward, Chief Administrative Officer, SDX Dysphagia Experts. Before we begin our conversation, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Bay Coast Bank. Bay Coast Bank is just right for all of your financial needs. Visit baycoast.bank or call 508-678-7641 to learn more. And Duncan Hearing Healthcare, hearing healthcare you can trust with sites in Fall River, Dartmouth, Falmouth, and Centerville. For more information, visit their website, duncanhearing.com. As always, you can support the 27th Degree with Chris and Nancy by subscribing to us on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform, and by following us on Facebook and Instagram. And also, please remember to leave feedback. It is greatly appreciated. So, Katrina, thank you so much for coming down to do the podcast with us. And you came all the way from Connecticut, so thank I appreciate you. That. You've gone
Thanks
through
for having me.
From another state to our humble podcast studio. Thank you. So tell us a little bit about yourself first and, you know, a bit about your line of work and what that entails. Why don't we start with that?
So I have a really cool job.
Okay, great.
I get to travel around to different nursing homes and mm-hmm. sometimes hospitals too, and I'm always working with different therapists and different patients, coming across new diagnoses, meeting folks brand new to the field, folks that have been in the field forever. And they call me in specifically to do this swallow eval that we call a FEES. It's a fiber optic, I like to use the F as functional, endoscopic evaluation of swallowing. Okay. And that lets us take a look on the inside and find out what's going on. So mm-hmm. a lot of times they get called in to kind of give that second opinion or to help a family or a resident make a decision mm-hmm. about what they want. And it's a really neat thing because when I come in, I'm taking pictures, I'm teaching the resident, I'm showing the nurses and the docs what it's looking like. The resident gets to sort of say, well, hey, you told me I had to have this special diet. And now you're saying maybe I don't have to have it. What are the risks? And I really get to focus on that patient-centered care piece. I have an awesome team I work with, so I'm very spoiled. We're a small group, and we cover about 400 facilities right now throughout New England.
So you're a speech therapist, but you're specialized in this other procedure that many speech therapists don't do. Mm-hmm. So when you're called in to provide this service, it's by, I would guess, other speech therapists in the facility. Of course, a doctor could put a referral in for you, and I would think that maybe rehab themselves could do it or nursing services.
All of the above.
All of the above.
And actually, not so much here in Mass, not so much in Connecticut. Rhode Island, we do get a lot of calls from nursing because a lot of folks are short-staffed when it comes to speech therapy in the skilled right. nursing setting. In Vermont and New Hampshire, a lot of times I'm getting my calls from the dietitians.
Okay.
Because they're the ones who are seeing the residents when they come in and saying, oh, look, Mr. Smith is on a modified diet. Why did that happen? What are we going to do? Okay, well, let's see. It sounds like he's gotten better, so maybe we can upgrade his diet. And that's when they give us a call.
You travel all over New England?
I do. Everywhere but Maine.
Everywhere but Maine. How many miles a year do you put on your car?
Oh, my gosh. That's a great question.
And then is it dependable on what kind of car is it?
Probably a couple thousand at least a month, I would say.
I would guess more than that, probably. Yeah, the way you're driving, I bet.
A lot of times I schedule it. So, like, if I'm going up to New Hampshire, I'm seeing three patients here, three here, two more on the way home.
Okay.
So we kind of make that.
You organize it.
Yeah.
So what made you want to go into speech therapy, and what does it involve to become a speech therapist? Our audience, I think, would be very interested in knowing that piece.
So I wanted to go into speech therapy because my mom said, don't just be a regular ed teacher. Pick something special. What about special ed or being a reading specialist? Ooh, come meet my friend Carol. She's a speech pathologist. And I'm like, oh, this is cool. I always wanted to be in a school, wanted to do that.
Sure.
I worked when I was an undergrad at Yale Child Study doing research on children with autism. And I'm like, this is my thing. I definitely found it. I loved that social skills piece. I loved the testing and the learning and the research. I had awesome professors who really let me explore a lot as an undergrad.
Sure.
Really thought I found my thing. Moved on to grad school. I was at Southern for both. I was really fortunate to be a scholarship kid and thank them for it every day. And as I went into grad school and went outside of the school into my first placement in the real world, I was like, wow, this adult thing is great. Mm-hmm. They have their own stories to share, and I don't have to discipline people. And, you know, you're not stopping every 5 minutes to say, Jimmy, get back on track. Jimmy, that's not what I said. It's such a great different environment. Yeah. And there's a lot more investment in what I had to share with my patients. And I just loved it. And then as I started to kind of explore the adult world a little more, I started to have adult clients. I had one fella I stayed in touch with until he passed away about 5 years later. We used to write postcards back and forth. I just got really attached to the adult population. And once I went into a hospital, I was like, oh, this is my thing. I loved it at pace. I really got into the swallowing piece because it was so black and white. And I liked being able to say, well, this is what I saw. This is what I didn't see. Now let's put that together and look at the big picture. And I just really enjoyed that piece of a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But you have the whole patient-centered approach there, too. You're not just looking at someone on paper or just looking at them in images. I'm going in and I'm meeting them and I'm hearing their story and talking to their family and their nurses.
So you started on speech pathology first. And then explain a little difference between the speech pathology, speech therapy. I think I'm not sure everyone understands that.
We all are lumped together.
Okay.
So here in the States, we're speech language pathologists, SLPs, technically. Okay. A lot of us just go by speech therapy because it fits in with physical therapy and occupational.
So it's all a lot of the same training.
Exactly.
Okay.
So when we start out, oftentimes, depending on the school you're at, you're in a program where you have probably some nursing students and a lot of your basic courses, your anatomy and all that stuff. You don't really get specialized until about your junior year. And that's when you start doing kind of what they call your weeding out courses. Okay. And for us, they're more child-based because that's where the majority of folks who go into speech practice. And it's things like learning the phonetic alphabet and being able to transcribe phonetics quick enough and accurately enough. You don't really get into the nitty-gritty stuff until you hit grad school. So at that undergrad level, what's really neat is once you start taking, they call it communication disorders, once you start taking those courses, you're with audiologists, future audiologists too. Okay. So at that point, you get your bachelor's and it's either in BS or it could be a BA, depending on the school you go to. And you decide what you want to do. You can't really practice with that bachelor's. We're starting to have a lot more opportunities now in the school systems and outpatient centers where you can be an SLPA, an assistant.
An assistant, okay.
No, ETs and OTs have
that. Right, right.
Medicare doesn't recognize it for speech.
Okay.
So in my medicine.
I never thought about that, but they have it in PT and OT and they don't have it in speech.
We don't. So I think we might get there eventually.
Yeah.
But right now what happens is you end up going on to get that master's degree to become an independent practitioner. And we have a national organization that we apply to get what they call our certificate of clinical competence. And that's it. You're on your own after you achieve that.
Do people go forward and get their doctorate or is it mostly master's level?
I would say mostly master's level, but more and more I have seen folks basically in my age from my classes go forward and move on to get an SLPD. I don't see a lot of folks going for the PhDs, and that's been super tough for our universities because the way they're accredited by that association we have, the American Speech Language Hearing Association, they have to have a certain number of professors that are on tenure and that are PhDs.
Okay.
So that's been a really tricky thing for our schools.
Is it a growing field? Because I feel like speech therapists are like a rare find. It's like, ooh, I got one.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're hard. They're hard to find and...
Yeah, I do think it's a growing field. I think we're going to see more need for our geriatric population as we move towards the 2030s, no doubt about it. We've got a lot of baby boomers that are going to be rolling into our nursing homes for probably for shorter rehab stays, but that's going to require someone to be there, not, speech is going to be here next week. You just hang on, and when they get here, they'll do that eval for you.
Exactly.
We're going to need that better turnaround time. We do have more programs opening up, but at the same time, we have programs closing. So I think it's kind of at a balanced out rate, even though we'd like to see more folks go into it. It's tough because you can't really do a lot of independent practice till you hit that master's level.
I see.
So as a speech therapist, you know, there's a lot of variety in what people do. Some work with young kids, you work with an older population. Tell me a little bit about what you do specifically with your patients that you see.
So... the way it usually works is I get a phone call or a text and someone says, I have a patient. Here's what's going on. I need to know what's happening on the inside. So can you come scope them and how soon can you be there?
Because they're not swallowing right. They have some choking, maybe some aspiration episodes, pneumonia, whatever.
A lot of times it's those pneumonia patients. That's a big trigger for our skilled nursing folks, especially.
Right.
That and the COPD exacerbations. We do still run into tons of folks where yeah, something's going on. You know, we noticed we had to put his oxygen up a little higher to keep him at 95%. And, you know, and sometimes we look and it turns out it's a little bit of chronic aspiration.
Right.
Not enough to push this person over the edge to a pneumonia, but keeps bumping up with these exacerbations related to it.
So what would be a clue that someone is chronically aspirating for our audience out there? Tell us a little bit about that.
What I tend to see, at least with our geriatric population, is we have typical changes to our swallow as we age. We expect things to get a little slower, and sometimes we have something go down the wrong way, maybe more often than it used to. But it's not a big deal because we're ambulatory. We're always up and moving. Our lungs are pumping. We've got a good cough. We brush our teeth so we don't have bacteria building up in our mouth. A big red flag I see for a lot of my older folks is maybe they've had a little chronic complaint of, oh, yeah, sometimes something gets stuck. Sometimes I cough and sometimes this. And every now and then that goes down the wrong way.
Coughing during eating would be like a clue.
And then something else happens and they end up with that illness because all of a sudden they're not getting out of bed.
Right.
We saw it a lot with COVID because as patients got sick, what happened? They stopped ambulating. In nursing homes, they weren't even coming out of their rooms for meals anymore in most cases. So just that change in that mobility every day, these folks who might have had a little chronic aspiration but could still pump those lungs well enough, all of a sudden are ending up with pneumonia.
Because they're lying in bed and they're debilitated and they're not as strong and they may be eating lying down, which is really hard to do.
We have that a lot.
I mean, that's hard for someone who doesn't have difficulty with swallowing.
Yeah, we run into a lot.
Very easily aspirate or choke.
Yep.
And so we see that in the nursing homes all the time.
So now you're dealing a lot with patients, you mentioned, like with some of the breathing disorders like the COPD, and I would imagine a lot of stroke patients. Are there any other like top diagnosis that, you know, if you have that or your loved one encounters that, it should kind of be in the back of your mind, oh, he's going to be at risk for our
That's a great question. A lot of Parkinson's.
Parkinson's is a big one.
Dementia, too.
Dementia is another big one. That's probably the biggest one that we see in the nursing home is dementia.
Can you talk a little bit about why, if you have a difficulty swallowing, it does put you at risk? Like, what is exactly aspiration, and why do you have to get worried about that?
So when you eat, you have to coordinate about 50 pairs of muscles and nerves to get everything down the right way. It's got to get into that food tube and not into that airway. Now, for us, if it gets into the airway, we're going to cough and clear it. Yeah. We're not going to let it sit there because we feel it. We're strong enough. We can do it. Well, for our folks who have some deconditioning, that little bit of aspiration at one meal and then a little bit more at the next meal and a little bit more at the next meal tends to build up. So we look for certain risk factors, some of those diagnoses we talked about. But then we also look at things like, what has their mobility status changed? Who's brushing their teeth? Are they getting their teeth brushed? One of the biggest populations, and we don't always think of it, that is at risk for pneumonia are the folks who are not eating by mouth. So our folks who have a feeding tube or are just made NPO temporarily because, okay, in 3 days they're going to be perkier. We're going to give them a chance to do another swallow test. Those folks that aren't eating because they're not clearing things and because those muscles get deconditioned so quickly, those are one of our highest risk populations to end up with complications like pneumonia should they aspirate.
I mean, it's interesting, not to interrupt, but we always think of G-tubes being placed in patients who can't swallow safely to protect them from aspiration, but the reality is they still aspirate.
We do have a lot of, I would say that it's made its way from being qualitative to quantitative research to say, especially with our folks with advancing dementia,
You know, no need to.
If we're putting in this feeding tube, we're not necessarily extending any quality of life. And in a lot of cases, the research has said that we're not actually extending the length of their life either.
And that's why I never recommend it in my advanced dementia patients because it doesn't really help on any front. They still aspirate. It doesn't increase their longevity, and the quality of life is clearly reduced. So, it's a tough thing for families to understand sometimes, though, because, you know, they don't want to, quote, starve their family members. But on the other hand, the feeding tubes don't help.
They don't. They really don't for those folks once they get
not for the dementia patients. I mean, there are some categories of patients where I think it makes sense, right?
I see a lot of great recoveries in our stroke patients, temporarily NPO. And I love to use the word temporarily because we really try not to keep someone strictly NPO. If we can give them ice chips, the best exercise they can do for rehab.
NPO, nothing by mouth.
And the best thing we can do for them is to get them to swallow. So if we can get them to eat ice chips or chew gum and just keep swallowing saliva, anything we can get in that mouth that's going to help them elicit swallowing is going to exercise those muscles.
Wait, so when do you do this? So if someone flunks a swallow eval, this is like, and you've, like, you, there's a little bit of hope that you're like, okay, well, will we evaluate you in 3 days, say? Like chewing gum is helpful for them.
If there's someone who can do it safely.
Okay.
So we have to look at all those pieces.
And ice chips, that kind of surprised me a little bit because it melts and becomes water. And I thought you were supposed to like...
That's right.
Ixnay with the water.
But it turns out it helps with the stimulation piece. So if you have someone who we know they can have good oral care, whether it's done by nursing or if they can do it independently, one of the really, I would say the hardest to rehab populations is our younger folks who end up with those lateral medullary strokes and a Waldenberg syndrome. The impact that has on their swallow, I mean, it's a good 6 month recovery period. It is a long haul for those folks. And they do tend to be a lot younger population too. And they don't have a lot of other issues.
Right.
A lot of, it's truly just the swallowing for some of these folks. Interior cervical disc fusions, depending on the approach, we also do see folks who go in to have the surgery and say, okay, my doc said that I'm going to be out of here. I'm going to go do my course of rehab. I'll be home in 2 or 3 weeks. But we don't always realize it just takes a tiny little nick in here. And until that nerve heals, our swallow function can basically get wiped out.
It can take a year.
It can. The older our folks are. And what we've learned is the longer we leave them not eating, that NPO status, the worse off they are. If we can just get those ice chips in, or if they can safely chew gum and swallow saliva, popsicles, anything that we can evaluate and say they can safely do this with oral care, with supervision, if we can set some kind of parameter to just get them swallowing, we're doing them a huge favor to get them to rehab that much faster.
What's the biggest challenge you have with families trying to like bend the rules?
Oh, that is a beautiful question.
Yeah,
and like, why shouldn't they? So what do they do? And then what's the reasoning where you're like cringing when they do it?
And I
understand where it's coming from.
I do too.
100%.
Think about it.
You know,
how did your grandma take care of you?
Right. Chicken
she
soup.
Cooked you delicious foods and brought you snacks, you know. So they're trying to sort of repay the favor. I mean, it's done with the best of intentions.
It's done with love, but sometimes patients aspirate. They get pneumonia. And I mean, they can have massive aspiration where they can, you know, acutely choke and, you know, expire from, you know, one event. Or they can get a pneumonia that, you know, or multiple pneumonias. There's a lot of bad things that can happen, right? So. Yeah, so it's interesting.
And it can be really confusing for the family members, too, because they come in and see mom eating a plate of spaghetti, and maybe it's not noodles. Maybe we're not talking about string pasta. Maybe it's a tiny elbow pasta, and it's very moist with sauce, and it doesn't have other chunks in it. But they think they can bring in the regular stuff with the nice big meatballs.
Right.
And if it's not that appropriate size and it's not cooked soft enough for her to chew, that's where we're putting our resident at risk. So I think there's a huge piece of education that SLPs and PT and OT and nursing, you know, it's fantastic. As of January 1st, we got a new set of codes we could use for caregiver education without the patient there. So if the resident needs to sleep, if they can't stay awake till 3 p.m. when their daughter gets out of work, that daughter can come in and sit down with me and have a face-to-face, and I can really help make it more concrete for them.
Good. So you've got someone who has some swallowing issues. Maybe they had a stroke or whatever the reason may be. What are some of the types of evaluations you can do or a doctor can order?
I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah? Sure.
This is... Tickle.
I think we need a swallowing eval right here. With
should have brought the skull.
Like, so funny, but let me just grab a drink of water.
Of course.
All right, Tyler, you're going to have to edit that out.
Do you want water?
Sure. If it's handy.
Yeah,
do you want a water, too?
I'm good. Thanks.
She's wearing the other.
Tyler will edit it all out. He's fine. We may have to do the fees on her or something.
There you go. We see a lot of reflux.
I see a lot of, you know, I've been seeing a ton of lately in my practice. It's not in the facilities, but a lot of like head and neck cancers lately.
More, huh?
Yeah, a ton. And they're all, a lot of them are HPV related.
That's what it, yep.
It's all HPV. And, you know, they respond pretty well, but they all end up with radiation and they can't swallow.
Yep. And it's not the changes. Yeah. They get go through this little healing period. Thanks so much.
It's amazing how much HPV there is out there.
Yeah, it is.
A lot of it. A lot of head and neck cancer.
And now all the kids are getting vaccinated, but no
worries.
We're
going to do a swallowing of Alanu later, Nancy.
That's awesome.
We'll do a part two. I'll bring the equipment.
We'll do a part two. We'll bring the equipment and we'll...
You know, I do worry about that because I find myself like coughing a little bit more. Like when I'm drinking, I'm like, oh, I really have to think now when I drink.
Yeah. I think you're an aspiration risk, Nancy. I think we need to look at that.
No doubt.
You're healthy. You're ambulatory.
Yeah.
You clearly have excellent mouth care. Like I've got no worries.
All right, there
Aspirate
we go.
Aspirate away.
Awesome. All right, so we were just talking about different swallowing evaluations that are done, and these are ordered, I guess, by nurses or doctors or, you know, or whatnot. But what are some of the things that are done as part of an evaluation for swallowing? Maybe you can just start at the beginning. You go see a patient, and what do you do?
So we to do a comprehensive eval, we kind of have bits and pieces that go together there. Okay. The first part is, hey, I'm a speech therapist. Nursing sent me over. They said you're having some problems. What's going on? And really find out from right. that patient, what's bugging them? What's behind this report I'm getting? And what happens is they say, nothing.
Okay.
I'm not having any problems. I'm fine.
They may not be aware.
I've been swallowing for 75 years. Yeah. I have no problems.
Okay.
So then we have to dive a little deeper. So we have some wonderful screening tools, self-report tools. One of them is the E10, and it's literally a little 10-question survey. There's the Pill 5. It's a little 5-question survey. You start asking those questions a couple different ways. Well, actually, yesterday and last week when I ate.
It comes out.
It does. Yeah. So you've got to just kind of keep at it, and you're going to get more answers for sure. So there's a nice interview portion. Part of that's going through the medical records. Right. Sometimes it's interviewing the family. I mean, I saw a fella maybe a month ago who had some bilateral vocal cord paralysis that no one knew about. It wasn't documented in his chart that this fella had survived a fire. He was a burn victim. He had been intubated for months. So when I went out to show the nurse the images and do a little follow-up, I said, so what happened? Does anyone know when this voice changed? She goes, actually, yeah, because I was talking to his sister, and here's what I found out. Mm. And then we were able to make all these connections.
Okay.
So really, that interview process is a huge piece of it. So
I mean, like you probably see that, too. Like, because a lot of people maybe don't want to complain about little stuff, so they're like, oh no, I'm fine. But then when you start diving deeper,
well, I think a lot of times, you know, these things happen, they can happen suddenly, like it sounds like in that particular case, but a lot of times it's just a gradual, insidious type of process with like many things in medicine, and then, you know, they normalize it, and then eventually it becomes too big of a problem to normalize. So I'll give you an example. I had a patient recently came in to me, and he says, I have a little thing on my neck. Well, he had like a grapefruit on his neck, right? So, you know, and he's fortunately doing well. But as it turned out, you know, it was a malignancy. But, you know, it's amazing to me always what patients can kind of put under, you know, slip under the rug, so to speak.
Yep. Or,
I'm not sure if that's the correct term, but, you know, they'll just live with something and until it just becomes really unbearable or noticeable. On the other hand, you know, you have other people who notice every little bit that's going on with them. But I think a lot of times, don't you think that's the case? The patient's just, you know, I've been living with it for a while. They're used to it. It's been going on. It develops over a number of years or so.
So you're finding a lot of your stuff with, like, digging those, like, extra levels.
And I always get the most honest answers from the spouses.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
And then I want to see how the patient actually eats. So
that's
pull some snacks out of my pocket. I might pop back in when they're having a meal, and maybe I'll bring them a cup of tea. And a lot of times, and the fellows do this all the time, they take these nice dainty bites. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, that looks great. Excellent pacing, nice and slow. You're chewing your food. And the wife will pipe up and say, that's not what happens at home.
Right.
Eats like a trucker.
That's so funny.
He will eat that sandwich in 5 minutes. And that's really what I want to see.
Yeah.
I want to see what's happening in real time.
Yeah.
So from there, if I really do think that there's something going on more in the throat part, maybe I want to get a look at the tissue. That's when I do the FEES test, the functional endoscopic swallow eval. If I'm thinking it's more in that esophagus and maybe there's some motility issues, maybe they've had a history of strictures, that's when we refer out for the barium swallows. Okay.
So it's like anything in medicine. It starts with a history. You do your examination, which, you know, in your case, there's probably some physical exam you do, but it's also the devices that you're using to kind of look down into the swallowing mechanism. And it gives you a general sense of what's going on. So
now, are you still using like the categories, oh, they need like nectar-thick liquids or like pureed consistency only or soft foods? Like what's that graduation ladder look like?
So I have really exciting news on
Oh, boy.
Thought I was going to be bored during COVID, so I jumped on board with our United States IDSI group. It's the International Dysphagia Diet Standardization Initiative.
Okay.
Nice. So it is a global initiative. It's already been going on for 10 years. The states are kind of the last folks to jump into the adaptation, but we are making progress little by little. I've had opportunities to teach a lot of dietitians about it, speech therapists. I kind of go around to conferences, and that's my thing, is teaching about the IDSI diets and why they're so beneficial. So these diets are the first time we've had a way to standardize things. So when the patient leaves the hospital on what they call a minced and moist level 5 diet and transitions over to Catholic Memorial and they have the level 5 minced and moist dysphagia diet, they're identical diets.
Isn't that nice?
Because they're standardized by particle size and moistness and softness so that we're really helping to create safer transitions, but we're also providing folks with a way to know what they're producing.
He's speaking the same language.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's been huge for research purposes, and it really has caught on clinically. We have a group that we're working with from Canada, and we're slowly starting another little outbranch of the IDSI group to kind of inspire people to get going with this because they've had such great success, and it's different there with the ministry and the way they roll things out.
Right.
Here, it's kind of state by
convoluted.
State. Yeah.
Right.
So company by company, but it has a lot of potential. And the nice thing about the levels is that there's more opportunities. So that minced and moist level is something, if you actually chewed your food and spit it out before you swallowed it, the particle size of what you chewed and spit out pretty much matches minced and moist level 5.
Okay.
So a lot of our folks who have ended up on puree all these years will have other options.
Nice.
That's good. So what are the levels from the least restrictive to the most? Tell us that.
So regular, and that's where our breads are. Bread is a huge choking risk. Bread really does, with the IDSI level specifically, sit at the end of regular. And then we work our way down, and there's even an easy to chew in there. Then we go from
an easy to chew.
Easy to chew. They call it easy to chew level 7.
Really?
It's basically softer cooked foods, but they're not cut up.
Okay.
So let's say you have dentures that are a little loose. You might want something that's just easier to chew, but you can handle cutting your own food and you're not a choking risk. That would be the diet level for you. If you are a choking risk, then you work your way down from there. And the next diet would be the SB6, and we call that soft and bite-sized. And the great thing about this, particle size. So we make sure that the particle size is not bigger than a thumbnail. So it's about a half inch, 15 by 15 millimeters.
Okay.
It can't block your airway.
And what kind of foods fit like in that?
Anything you prepare.
So it's really on me.
Yeah. Oh. So the kitchen would cook it soft enough, and they would do what we call a fork pressure test. They'd push down on it and make sure it's soft enough that it squishes a little. They could use the tines of the fork to measure it or thumbnail and say, okay, that's about thumbnail size. But if we keep it that small and someone has their food land on top of their airway, it'll pass between those vocal cords and it won't obstruct the airway.
Okay.
Oh, that's
because
smart.
It's small enough. So they'll either be able to cough it out or we'll find it later on in a chest x-ray, but we're reducing that risk of choking.
Okay.
And the next level?
Then we go to minced and moist level 5. And after that, we move down to our puree. And we do have what's interesting too. Other countries have had this level called, now it's called slightly thick. We always thought of it as like a tomato juice or a natural nectar. They use it a lot in infants with their formulas for regurgitation.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So that's actually a standard level in IDSI, and I think it will eventually have a lot of applications for our folks with respiratory challenges like our CHF, COPD, and pneumonia patients when they're in an active episode or acute change in function and respiratory coordination. That level just being a little bit thick, we just don't have the commercial ability to provide that easily yet. When you have the other drinks coming out and they're already pre-thickened and ready to serve, those are your thin, and then it's mildly thick, which used to be nectar, moderately thick, which used to be honey, and then extremely thick, which is like your pudding thick.
Okay.
You know, the one thing that my patients always complain the most about to me when I was hospital-based was thickening up their drinks. They hated that.
Water.
Oh, can you imagine putting thicket in coffee? I mean, it's like that. It was abhorrent to them. So is it? It's like the thicket stuff still out there,
and it's getting better.
Yeah,
it's getting better now.
Constantly improved.
That's cool.
Thicket actually has a new product that's coming out on the market very soon. Clear Advantage, and it's a xanthan gum powder, so folks can mix it up and it can sit a little longer. We're really getting away from those starch-based products.
Yeah.
PrimaCare is Southeastern New England's trusted leader in medical care. With offices in Fall River and surrounding communities, we're dedicated to your well-being. Our carefully selected team of more than 150 providers offers world-class primary and specialty medical care. PrimaCare doctors are supported by a skilled staff trained to deliver comprehensive radiology, imaging, and testing services. PrimaCare is large enough to take care of all your medical needs, but small enough to care for you personally. PrimaCare is by your side.
The pureed food, I mean, it's so hard for some of these nursing home patients to deal with. I mean, a big part of our experience of eating, right, is texture. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can take something you enjoy taste-wise, let's say scallops, and puree, and it's completely disgusting. But yeah, but it's but that's what you have to do so you don't aspirate or whatnot. So
yeah,
it is what it is. But yeah, I look at some of what the folks I take care of have to eat, and I give them a lot of credit. It's tough. It's not easy.
So how do you know if people can graduate from level to level? And is there just like, this is it? This is the best you're going to get? And like, when do you call it?
I reevaluate, and I'm really stubborn, and I never call it. So, and I say to my folks, hey, look, you were sick 2 weeks ago. I completely understand why the hospital wanted you on the thick and liquids. You were having a lot more difficulty coordinating and breathing. Here you are today. You did it. Thin liquids it is. But if you get sick again, we're going to have another conversation and another evaluation. Swallowing just goes like this. It's just a roller coaster.
A lot of people progress and take a step back and progress again. Yeah. And it's a lot of that goes on.
I see it a lot with my tardive dyskinesia folks.
Sure.
When your meds get changed.
Yeah.
That's a big.
Now, one of the things, again, I'll go back to my hospital-based days, like nursing was allowed to do some basic stuff before you had to get the speech therapy, like the big guns in there. And I don't know if it was just because of the speech therapist was high demand, right? So instead of waiting like days, they gave us a little bit of authority.
What kind of stuff did you do as a nurse? For swallowing evaluation,
like just the gross stuff, like the gross
bedside,
meaning,
you know,
yes, exactly like that.
See how they choke, do they cough,
yes,
whatever.
Yes, yeah, we have the suction right
like
there.
A little checklist.
I mean,
kinda,
yes, it was very, very basic. We weren't pretending
that
we were
you,
speech therapists.
It clues you in whether or not a speech therapy eval would be necessary.
Well, yeah, and gave them a little bit of freedom to eat or drink a little bit of something before they got the evaluation.
Right. And pills is a huge one. Because,
right.
I mean.
Right. So can you explain what that world looks like now? And
very similar.
Okay.
A lot of that hasn't changed. What a lot of hospitals have done protocol-wise is we have a nursing screen for our stroke patients, and that's part of it for the stroke patients. We had a lot of great research come out of Yale when Stephen Leder was still with us, and he did the 3-ounce water protocol, and that really caught on like wildfire. And folks use that all the time. Some of my dietitians in Vermont and New Hampshire use that as part of their screening. And it's designed to be a screening tool, and you look at the patient's alertness, you give them the 3 ounces, and if they have to pause or they have to cough, it's considered a fail. Because that's the thing about the screen, right? Pass or fail, and then from there you decide, okay, well, we need to go on to the next bring in speech. Let's get the comprehensive. Do we need the instrumental? And then you kind of have your flow chart down that way.
So then when the, I'm sorry, but these are all nursing questions because I want to know. So when you're suctioning a patient, like when you're brushing, we talked about brushing someone's teeth. Now, sometimes, you know, for like a vent patient or something like that. Some in the home, because I'm home-based now as a nurse, we are seeing some people with the toothbrush that has the suction capability, which is great. Amazing. But then there's other, you know, sometimes you're brushing someone's teeth and just using a suction cath. Mm. I mean, is there a risk one way or the other?
the suction cath is better than nothing. Something I do push, especially with my residents with dementia, is some of them just don't like the toothpaste.
Yes.
And if you can just get the brushing action, get the bristles on the teeth and the gums and the tongue,
right,
great. If it's the toothpaste that's turning them off, yeah, that's not the end of the world. Aim for the toothpaste and a little bit of maybe just a little water to moisten that up.
Mm-hmm.
But if the toothpaste is to make it or break it,
yeah,
I'm okay with walking away from that one. Even if they don't have the freshest breath, I mean, that's not that important to them.
Yeah.
And sometimes, too, you know, if you eat, if you brush with toothpaste and then you go and eat, it does kind of alter your food taste for a brief little interval.
Right.
Our folks with dementia have a very hard time with taste as it is, and they're only picking up certain things. So with them, sometimes less is more.
So are there little things that you see as you go around to different facilities or organizations that you always find yourself teaching? And like, what are some of those teaching points?
One of my favorites, and it goes back to mouth care. I get this all the time from my facilities. I'm like, why aren't they brushing her teeth? If we just brushed her teeth, I'd feel a lot better about saying, let her have fins. If she only aspirated during her swallow test on one out of every 10 sips, that's not so bad at all. But she's got all this junk in her mouth, and she's going to take that down into her lungs when she aspirates.
There's a lot of bacteria and whatnot.
Yeah, and it really does get cakey over time.
Yeah.
So something you can do is just with the toothbrushes and positioning. So really standing behind that person, using a mirror in front of them, and kind of cradling their head. And when you're brushing, you can use those fat-handled brushes. And to actually help with the tonic bite, you can get one brush on this side where they're just biting, and it'll hold that open enough so that you can brush the other side a little more easily. They even have bite blocks that work. But it takes a little practice, and you got to have patient nurses' aides to do this. And they have to be comfortable with kind of rescuing each other at certain times. Listen, if you start and the resident's not feeling it, don't keep going.
Just come
walk
back
out of that room. Give them the 5 minutes to re-loop their memory and come back in.
And sometimes their bite releases a little bit, too. Like, if they're biting down, so then you just brush the front and the front on the bottom. And by that time, you're finding, like, that little crevice to kind of get in. And
back in stages.
Yeah.
Not even come back. You're just doing what you can. But, like, 20 seconds later, because you're, like, you're working on the fronts, they'll open up a little bit.
Back, it's not
we all have that, like, little space, like, right here that you can wiggle the brush in. And then you're all set.
It's patience and
it's patience and approach.
Yep.
And brushing the roof of the mouth and the tongue, too, is very important because so many people
dementia patients,
you have
to really, it's all in the approach.
It is.
You know,
yes.
You have to approach them in a very particular way. And, you know, they will feel aggression if you're coming at them too strongly, as you know.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, where a lot of people go wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's definitely been that's been a huge learning experience for me because I'm going in someone's nose.
Right.
I'm a complete stranger to them, but they're trusting me to do this. So I do a lot of touching and teaching and saying, this is where I'm going to go, and I'm going to go up here, and here's how it's going to feel. And now we're going to look at the scope together, and here it comes, and this is going to feel cold and wet. And now we're going to move on through, and let's count together. And those little bits and pieces really help. One of the best ways I have to help my residents with dementia feel more relaxed is to sort of engage them in a different task while I'm putting the scope in. Because if Mrs. Smith sees that delicious brownie in front of her and she hasn't been allowed to have that for a whole week and a half since she came back from the hospital, and I can say, Mrs. Smith, go ahead and take a bite of that, and now I'm going to follow it down with my camera. That multitasking at a certain level of dementia advancement doesn't really exist. So she can enjoy that and kind of forgets that I'm even there.
So let's talk about the test, actually, with these, because a lot of people don't know.
Before we get that, can I just finish up tips and tricks? Because what I see a lot, too, especially if like a nurse's aide is left to feed a patient, some of them do a great job, but some of them is just like rush, right? Like they're beating the clock, right? And then you have someone who's pocketing food. And so can you tell me a couple of like little tips and tricks, like first with the pacing of feeding someone, and then what do you do if someone's pocketing food? Like what's the best way to get them to swallow it?
They've got to stop feeding when someone's pocketing, and that's the last thing folks do, because if we don't see it right at the front of the mouth, we assume it's been swallowed, so we bring up that next bite. So really, pacing is so important. And for some residents, when I actually do the swallow test, I'll say, listen, it took her about 15 seconds to move that food back, and then she held it at the back of her tongue for another 10 seconds before she swallowed. So we'll go as far as to say to the CNAs, one bite every minute. Slow and steady. And we'll give give a real specific parameter to sort of work through that.
That's great.
But with pocketing, you've really got to just check that mouth at the end, making sure nobody lays down after they eat. Because if it's sitting in here, eventually the saliva is going to loosen it up and they're going to bring it back and hopefully swallow it. But if they lay in bed, that's it. Yeah. We just opened that airway up.
Is there like doing this or this that stimulates
anything? I think ice cream is one of the best stimulators. Going with something really cold and sweet for our folks with dementia, it helps to kind of reawaken them. Mm-hmm. So when you do see them getting really slow with the food or they kind of purse those lips and they're not really into it anymore. Right. If you switch it up, it kind of reawakens their senses with the sweet and cold, and then you might get in a few more successful bites. Yeah. I do go to a lot of facilities still where they'll take the puree and they'll mix it up with the liquids and give it to them to drink. There is a blenderized diet that can come out of the kitchen, and that would really be the best way to do something like that. It would be a recommended diet level, but doing that without a recommendation really isn't what's right for the patient. Mm.
I like the ice cream idea.
Me too.
If I develop dementia, I just want ice cream all the time.
I'm with you.
And brownies. So,
yeah, exactly.
Are there better foods to like that puree good versus the scallops?
Yeah, I would refrain from pureeing scallops. That would be definitely one.
But what are people's favorites like to put in a blender and say, here you go?
Bread is such a tough one, but it is a favorite. So there are a lot of great recipes out there now talking about how to take the breadcrumbs. You actually start with the frozen bread, grind it up into crumbs, and then you actually reconstitute it back with a thickened liquid so that it stays moist enough and is truly a puree. So there's a lot going on with bread now where people are starting to think outside the box, and then they can take that over to other kind of desserts. Oh, well, it could be chocolate bread. Now we just made a brownie. Oh, well, it could be banana flavored. Now we just made banana bread. So there's a lot of different ways they can start to incorporate things and kind of give our folks who truly need a puree, a bit more variety. Because really, what's the snack they always get?
Applesauce.
Maybe a pudding on a lucky day, but it's, I mean.
Yeah, I guess it's not surprising why some of these folks lose weight. It's not terribly appealing, but unfortunately, it's necessary.
Is there a great site for the recipes, or are people basically doing like Google searches for like pureed diets?
There are some. You can go on YouTube and look for pureed hot dog recipes, pureed bread recipes, and actually see people doing it.
Scallop recipes. Yeah,
there you go. You're going to develop that one. That'll be yours. Thicket has a recipe book. There's some other thick and liquid companies that are out there that have put recipe books out. But there's really been a push. A lot of it has to do with social media where folks are like, show me how to make this happen. Rubicon is another company where I've seen a lot of their videos and their production. One of the dietitians I work with in Mass, Mary Rybicki, actually co-authored the Nutrition Care Manual and really helped to get IDSE going in the U.S. And that's a company she works with who really does a lot of, this is what you can do. Believe it or not, they put this in front of you and say, that's puree. And you're like, there's no way. And then you dig into it and you're just so surprised. Pureed donuts.
Oh, my God.
I mean, really making it wonderful.
I am so glad you're on the show today. Pureed donuts. That's what we're calling this episode. Tyler, we put it out. Pureed donuts.
So, all right. Now I need to know about the fees.
Okay. So.
What's it stand for? We'll start with that.
So it's fiber optic endoscopic evaluation of swallowing.
Okay.
Or what I like to call it is the functional endoscopic evaluation of swallowing. Because it is really function-based. When I come in to do a fees, I'm working with another therapist. And they're trusting me to kind of give a second opinion in a way.
Okay.
So my question is always, what are you looking to find out? What's your goal? What's your resident's goal? Sometimes the residents, they can flat out say, my goal is no more thickener. I don't ever want that again. I say, okay, we're going to work with that. And the speech therapist might say to me, yeah, I just want him to eat more. Okay, well, now here we are in common ground. If we had a better diet and we had liquids that he enjoyed more, I guarantee you he'd eat more. So let's work on this together. And we do the test, and I do talk the patient through a lot of it. So it starts with the scope going up one side of the nose and looking down the throat. And I shine that bright light down on those vocal cords. I can see the airway, make sure that it's patent. I can usually view a few tracheal rings. Patients that have more narrow throats, if they have an osteophyte or two in the back, just those typical kind of arthritic changes, things do tend to narrow. So I might have them move their head into a couple different positions to get a really nice look.
And you can see when they're swallowing the mechanism and how it
I can make sure those vocal cords are closing nice and tight. Sometimes what I see is that they don't open enough. And these are our patients who have more trouble voicing and breathing. But then when I see in action that they're actually not doing a lot of abduction, then it kind of fits the picture of why that patient's voice isn't working quite right for them, or why they're running out of breath so frequently because they can't valve even for speech or activity. So imagine for swallowing where you actually have to hold your breath when you swallow. So then we start with our food trials if we're going to pursue food. Now, sometimes if someone's been non-oral nutrition, NPO for a long time, we actually start with those ice chips. And there's even an ice chip protocol that they put together a few years back and said, listen, if your patient's loaded with secretions because they haven't eaten, give them a chance to clear the secretions. And you literally start with the teenier ice chips, those little crushed kind, and you do one and you let them swallow and you do two and you go up to five or six or really as many as you need. And if we can get some mobility of those secretions out of the way, we're going to move on to PO trials. If it's someone who's already eating, we're going to start with where they're at and we're going to work our way up and really let them feed themselves. So that fella who is taking these nice teeny bites and then looks around and no one's looking and he shoves half that sandwich in, that's what I want to see on my face. So really getting the patient to mimic. The ones we talked about who eat in bed, a lot of my folks are like that because they're in so much pain. I can't sit up. I literally have to recline when I eat. Give them the button. Show me where you go when you eat. A lot of times I sit them up and they put themselves back here. And if that's what they're doing, that's how I want to test them. So we really make it functional.
That's hard to do if you have normal swallowing. I mean,
so
it's very difficult if you're, you know, deconditioned or have other health issues.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. So the scope itself, how big is it?
Cooked spaghetti. That's what I tie it to.
Oh, it's that small, really?
Itty-bitty.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know it was that small. And it's a little fiber optic camera on it. You go, it's not like putting an NG tube in, which,
not
you know, is uncomfortable because I used to. I remember back in my residency and internship days doing that. It was torture to a lot of patients. But
this is easy.
This is tiny. They don't feel a lot of discomfort or if any.
Now, where can this test be done?
Right at the bedside. Literally.
So can you do it in the home environment?
We do sometimes. Yep.
Yeah. So this is an added tool. So you have a speech therapist who does an evaluation and say, we want to have this, perhaps to get a little more information, and then you come in and do it. How much extra training did you have to be able to do this type of a procedure?
It's basically a course, and then you have to have someone who will supervise your first set of scopes until whatever facility or agency you're with considers you privileged.
Okay.
I was at Hartford Hospital way back then, and they wouldn't privilege me till I finished my first 9 months, and I had what my C's, my certificate of clinical competency. So once I had that, then they let me start scoping patients with supervision. And I want to say they made me do about 35, and then the physiatrist had me do a written exam and passed me through.
Do you think this is an underutilized tool?
Definitely.
Yeah, I would think so, too. And I think part of the reason, this is my take on it, is I don't think that practitioners understand that this is the size of cooked spaghetti. They're thinking of like what the, you know, what they're used to seeing with NG tubes or
a GI scope.
Or GI scopes and whatnot, you know, which is, you know, at least a pinky, I guess. Yeah. So I think there's probably is less... There needs to be more education out there about what this really entails.
I've had folks tell me it's easier than a COVID swab, which I believe because you are looking instead of just pushing. We're seeing the whole pathway. We take the path of least resistance, and that's it.
So with like an endoscope, you know, the GI docs use, you know, you can kind of control the movement of it. It's the same type of thing?
Yep.
Well, okay. Yep. Interesting.
What's the advantage of this test over the barium swallow?
Usually if these can be done faster, because it's done by, it's just a speech rehab procedure versus your barium swallow, you have to have your physician present too because you're administering barium. Some states, actually Mass is one of them, where the SLP can administer barium. Other places are a little more rigid on that, on how that's done within radiology and within a radiology suite. But with fees, it's just an SLP.
Yeah.
So it's a rehab code and a rehab procedure. So it's pretty quick. We usually get to our sites within 48 hours of a call.
What information will you get from that you don't get from a barium swallow?
When I do a FEES, I can really test the patient. So it gives me this great array of needing to be super conservative for that NPO patient versus this guy's eating regular and he's still having COPD exacerbations and I need to know why. So that patient that I have to be super conservative, I'm going to start with those ice chips. I'm going to go slow and steady. I'm going to watch their saliva swallows. I might tap around to get a better idea of their sensation on the inside. When I get to that patient that's the complete opposite of that spectrum, that's the patient where I'm going to say, chug. Mm-hmm. I want to see you drink this whole thing without coming up for air, because that's probably where I'm going to catch the aspiration as soon as they hyperextend that neck.
Yep. Okay.
So it really, the FEES lets me have that advantage, the functional piece of it, where I can really tailor that test to just what that resident does and what I think they can do. So I can keep pushing. There's no time limits because there's no right. radiation. So, I mean, there's times where my arms tire out before the resident
right,
does.
Right.
And if I'm a patient, like for me, I probably want to go through a FEES test rather than the barium swallow.
They're both interesting. I've done them both, and both interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't like the taste of barium.
Me neither.
So there came a time when I started doing the FEES after I left the hospital with the group I'm with now, and it was initially started by an SLP. Now we're still owned by the rehab family. Our owner's a PT. And when the SLP that had started the company had brought me on, the equipment was taller than me. It was literally, it looked like I was a band. And it stacked up like these big cabbage cases on top of a platform. And that's what would roll into the patient's room. The equipment was still tiny, but we were recording on video. We had literally a travel medical printer, very different setup. So, I mean, that looked super intimidating. I don't think you could even see me behind the cart. It was that much taller than me. And now it's a laptop and a camera. And I can sit it right here.
That's
and
great.
The resident gets to watch everything.
It's very comfortable.
And the ones that say, I don't want to see it, I said, don't worry, I'm going to make you a video. And if you change your mind later, we can look at it.
Oh, that's so
cool.
And so
they get it in a portal, and then they're able to look at it down the road when they're comfortable with it.
Beautiful.
Yeah. I bet there's a lot of interest. I bet a lot of residents do like to look at that.
They do. They do. And
I would.
It's very neat to see.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And then you understand what's going on. And like, it probably makes you more compliant because you're like, then you realize, oh, I really can't have that because this is going to.
I can really show them, this is what happened when I gave you the thickened liquid. Nothing went into your airway. That V right there, those are your vocal cords. And there's your airway underneath it. And it's clear.
Yeah.
Then we drank that thin water and you see that blue. I like to use food color because it really helps when I explain it in the pictures too. And it really stands out. That blue that went between the V, that's actually the water starting to make its way down your windpipe. You were able to cough it out to me. So I'm confident that we can work on strategies and get you to do a cough every time and hopefully upgrade that diet. But right now, until you can do that all the time, I need you to stick to those thickened liquids to stay away from another pneumonia. Is that okay with you? And usually they'll be like, okay, so you're not telling me forever. You're telling me I can pick.
Right.
You're giving me a little parameter. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to learn my strategy and then we'll graduate.
I think that, you know, we've talked very technically about some things, but I think just the approach and the communication when you're limiting someone's diet is so important too, because you can get really bummed out if someone's like, no, this is it. Yeah. And you're like, oh.
Right.
And that does happen a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, I find, especially with our long-term care folks, you might get an SLP fresh out of school who comes in and covers a building, and they might be there for 9 months while they do their fellowship 9 months, and maybe they'll stay another 3 and make it a year, but then they leave. And then when that new SLP comes in, there's a whole slew of long-term care patients that aren't getting screened regularly. We're not picking up the weight losses. Dietary might be, but they're not always sending them over our way. Med changes. If I'm not over there saying, hey, have you had any med changes on Mr. So-and-so?
Right.
And you don't really know all your residents. So many things fall through the cracks until they circle back with an acute problem.
Right.
It's hard.
Can I ask another kind of like technical question? Why is straws bad?
I love that question. They're not always bad.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes straws are fantastic.
Oh.
So what I do on the FEES, it goes back to that functional thing, I test straws. Always. Because for some of my folks, it makes a beautiful difference.
Yeah.
Think about someone with Parkinson's or more oral difficulty. So if it's more of a containment issue or they have weakness on one side from a stroke, that straw can be a huge, huge comfort to them.
Okay.
Other folks, it
I
puts...
I thought straws are bad.
It can be because they can put it too far back and then it moves too quick. You don't know if you don't test it. That's what I say. But I have patients tell me all the time, the hospital said, I can't do it. Yes. I said, I understand, but now we're going to test it. And let's find out in pictures if we can make it work for you.
One of those things that was like a rule that now we're realizing is not necessarily always the case, right?
I love it. Groundbreaking stuff for me here.
Yeah, that's great. See?
Right?
Very interesting. Yeah, this is really fascinating. I mean, it's fascinating just to know what a speech therapist can achieve with our patients. And I didn't know much about the fees, so that's really an interesting procedure.
Same.
It's nice to know that the scope is that thin, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, patients usually tell me, it felt like there was something in there that didn't want to come out.
Yeah.
It just felt a little annoying. I'm like, okay, I will take
That's fine,
that.
But it's not painful, at least. It's just maybe at the most annoying for whatever time period you're doing it. How long does it take?
It depends. If we're just looking really specifically for a few things, I might be in and out in 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah.
If I want to see what happens when this patient fatigues, so think our patients with myasthenia gravis, right? Strong start on those meals about 10 minutes in. They start getting tired, and you do see that fatigue in those muscles. We keep going, we keep going, we keep going. We might try and get 25 or 30 minutes out of them to really hit that significant fatigue point because your swallow can change a lot in that time period. Okay.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
This is great.
Yeah, I think so. We got a lot of information.
We sure did. Yeah, I think that our audience will truly enjoy this. Is there one message you want to leave our audience before we finish?
I'd like to inspire them all to check out the International Dysphagia Diet Standardization Initiative.
Okay.
If we could just all speak the same language, and maybe it's selfish of me because I go to so many nursing homes and hospitals.
That's crucial.
If we just all spoke the same language and made sure that our foods were prepared the same way across the board,
right,
we'd have happier patients, we'd have happier staff, we'd have safer transitions. It would make life easier for all the caregivers. So
that's great.
Nice.
Thank you so much. Thanks for coming from Connecticut.
Thanks for having me.
You've traveled farther than any of our other guests.
Cool.
So we appreciate. I wish we had a prize for you for that.
I know.
We really appreciate it. This was really a great conversation. And thank you to everyone for listening to our show. If you'd like to become a sponsor, please contact us at 774-319-4230. Special thanks to my good friend Ron Gamache for our intro music. PrimaCare, your trusted medical providers in southeastern New England, and BioSkills of Northeast for producing our show. And Available produce your show by calling 774-301-8811. And this is really a great space. And if you are looking to do a podcast, I don't think you can find a better space. We've been in a few.
Or a better producer.
Yes.
We have a
great producer. Tyler is excellent. Absolutely. There he is. Thumbs up. And, of course, Bay Coast Bank, just right for all of your financial needs. Visit baycoast.bank or call 508-678-7641 to learn more. And Duncan Hearing Healthcare. Hearing healthcare you can trust with sites in Fall River, Dartmouth, Falmouth, and Centerville. For more information, visit their website, duncanhearing.com. Thanks again. We really appreciate you being here. And usually we say, you know, how would people call you if they want to contact you? But you're in a nursing facility, so it's a little different. But if there was a facility out there that wanted to get in touch with you, how would they contact you?
The best thing to do is visit our website.
It's okay.
SDX-fees.com.
Okay.
And that will give them access to more of our information.
Great.
Any residents, any patients out there that are interested in learning more, other therapists that are interested in learning more about it, nursing, it's there. So it's
and you travel everywhere in New England.
We do.
Except for Maine. You folks in Maine are on your own. I'm sorry, but I'm sure
we'll get up there.
I'm sure there's other resources up there, but maybe you'll get up to Maine at some point. Do you travel outside of New England?
Not yet.
That's coming.
You never know.
All right.
Never say never.
All right. Well, thanks again. We appreciate it greatly.
Yeah. Thank you so much.